Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the belated third and final part of our mini podcast trilogy dedicated to Empire's list of the 50 greatest movie heroes of all time, as voted for by the readers of Empire Magazine and the listeners of this very podcast. Anyway, it's time to cut to the chase as we enter the top 10. And when I say we, I mean Helen O'Hara, Ben Travis, Amon Warman, and myself. And if you haven't already listened to parts 1 and 2, do check them out after this on the podcast app of your choice. And I have to say, this is definitely it, the last of a series that started out as a single episode of no more than an hour in length until it became apparent that none of us could keep our trap shut when it came to talking about characters we love, and in some cases, love not so much. Anyway, I say last, but we might do an omissions podcast down the line. No! Bad, Chris. Bad. Anyway, here we go. Straight into it, kind of, with number 10 on the list. Enjoy. It's number 10. Amon, do you want to should we get the Ludwig Göransson music going here?
Yeah. It's
Whenever you're ready. Anytime you want to come in.
Is a Black Panther, T'Challa, the warrior king of Wakanda. He is at number 10. And yes, love this character. It's interesting. I think if you look at Thor, who we talked about a while ago, obviously, he is a king, a prince who, you know, becomes a king. And in the first film, between him and Anthony Hopkins and Rene Russo, there was some regalness that you've got. But the journey that character goes through has seen him become less and less regal the more we've seen of him. With Black Panther, the first moment you see him is like, the way this guy carries himself is different. And you really get that. And even, you know, from Civil War to Black Panther to Infinity War to Endgame, he always carries himself in that regal way. And that, for me, is a big deal. And I love also how wise he is as well. And his, you talk about somebody who's more accomplished, is in the right place. To let Zemo go at the end of Civil War is a big deal. To the point where even at the end of Black Panther, how many heroes after a big battle with their nemesis who's threatened to plunge their entire country into ruin would do what he did in terms of taking him up to, you know, to give him that view of Wakanda in the end, to even say, maybe we can still hear you. Yeah. There's only one here in the MCU who would do that, and that is T'Challa. And, you know, that's just one of many reasons that I think he's superb.
Yeah, he's a thinker in a way that I don't think, you know, like Tony is a thinker, but in a very, very different way. His brain works in a very, very different way.
Yeah.
But he's a thinker in a way that I don't think any other hero in the MCU is. He has compassion in a way that I don't think, you know, Steve obviously has lots of compassion as well, but he is a very compassionate character also. He contemplates his place in the firmament also. You know, his decision to throw open the doors of Wakanda at the end of the first Black Panther movie is huge. But one of the most interesting things, I think, you're talking about the way that Chadwick Boseman plays the character Amon, is one of the most interesting choices, I think, is the voice. Because the voice is not Chadwick Boseman's voice. It's not even close to Chadwick Boseman's voice. And there's a stillness about it. There's a quietness about it. Whenever he speaks, you have to listen because he's quite softly spoken. And it's the complete antithesis in certain ways of how heroes sound, or how we believe heroes should sound, which is with a deep, manly bass, heavy voice. You should listen to me, for I'm commanding. And he's absolutely not that at all. I think this is a character that, you know, there was so much riding on. You know, this is a character that, you know, his appearance on the big screen was overdue, I think. But when they brought him into the MCU, I think they got it absolutely right.
For me, he's still Civil War. I've stated many times that Civil War is still my favorite MCU movie. He is one of the main reasons why. He is phenomenal. He's only in that movie for about 20 minutes, and every single scene he's in is just incredible. But yeah, just to your point about Black Panther, it is still, I have never experienced so much pride watching a film before as I did when I watched Black Panther. It's a superb movie in that regard, not just in because of the way he carries himself, like I mentioned, but just in terms of what that film does in terms of showing Black people and showing Black joy and, you know, showing part of Africa, fictional, or no, obviously this is fictional, but which has been uncolonized, which has been fully allowed to develop on its own steam. And this is the result of that. And to show that on screen in a big Marvel movie, because, you know, this is a point which has been made ad nauseum, but when you see Africa normally in movies, it's not like that at all, to put it mildly. That was a big deal. It's a big deal for so many reasons. We don't have enough time to get into all of it, but you know, I would only add that Chadwick Boseman, it was interesting reading the reviews of Black Panther at the time, because people were rightfully, you know, going on about Michael B. Jordan's performance, rightfully so. It's a fantastic performance. It's the showier performance, and people weren't really paying that much attention. I remember a lot of people at the time were calling Chadwick Boseman boring and that character art boring, but if you go back and watch that film, it's actually not. There's a number of really great subtle moments he gets to play, because in his mind, he's been betrayed by his father in a big way. And his performance is actually fantastic. It's subtle, but it's fantastic. And I'm really looking forward to seeing more of him in the MCU.
The other thing I'd just add to kind of what both of you have said, and particularly going to Chris's note about his voice, is I think he's almost entirely free of insecurity, and especially kind of that male fragility that you sometimes get. He will absolutely go to women for advice, and does go to women for advice, and is surrounded by incredible women, and listens to them and takes that stuff on board in a way that is quite modern, I think, and quite rare still to find. And it just speaks to this character where he knows who he is. He absolutely knows who he is. He absolutely knows what his position is in life. He has no doubts on that score. He has no reason to have doubts on that score, and he acts accordingly. And so there is no trace of insecurity in himself. He is put in very difficult positions, and he, you know, has to figure out how to deal with those. But I think it's really good to see a role model like that for anyone. I don't care about your skin color. For anyone to see a role model like that who just knows who he is, who just accepts himself, and who just listens to whoever has the best ideas, I think it's an amazing thing to see.
When Killmonger asks that question, when he's, "Is this your king?" I'm always like, "Yeah, man, it is. He is the king. He's the dude." In terms of what the film does in and of itself and the message that it provides, I love that whole ending where they literally bring it back to the kids in Oakland, the way that, that he and Shuri take the resources that they have and plow it back into the real world. So that is an amazing way to end the film itself, but as a message to send through that film, through this huge Marvel blockbuster, I think is an incredible thing. And the way that that character changes through Black Panther, the way that he sort of comes to understand his father's legacy in a different way and decides, makes an active choice to do something different, sees what the bad things are in a very short tenure of being a leader and having already been challenged by somebody else, to make a big change like that and stick by it and it be absolutely the right decision, I think is a great thing. I love the arc of that character, and I agree with Amon that I think people didn't necessarily click onto what Chadwick Boseman was doing in that film or what Black Panther as a character was doing in that film, but I think it really, really stands, especially on repeat viewings.
Yeah.
Okay, so yes, T'Challa at number 10. At number 9, it's Kal-El. It is Superman, the son of Jor-El, the son of Argyle. Come to me, Superman! Superman! It's Superman. Oh my god. Superman!
Yeah, look, he might have the best theme of any of these heroes.
I was just about to say that. Okay, because, you know, spoiler alert, James Bond's coming up, Batman is coming up, Luke Skywalker's coming up, Indiana motherfucking Jones is coming up. There's pretty good themes.
Yeah, Indy's probably the biggest challenge there, though, isn't it?
It's
got to be John Williams.
Yeah.
I think, look, I mean, my views on Superman are well documented. I think he is the bomb. I think anyone who thinks he's boring is not paying attention. I am still in the Christopher Reeve camp. I still think that has yet to be surpassed. But I am very willing to be wrong about that in the future. And I hope that there are more Superman films to prove me wrong on that. But I think what people fail to understand is it's quite difficult to be good, and it's quite difficult to you know, put yourself out there and save people all the day and take responsibility essentially for the entire world, which is more or less what he does. Like Spider-Man, you know, superpowers don't necessarily make his life easier always, even though they totally could with his ludicrous array of superpowers. Like, he could do freaking anything. And instead he goes around like saving buses of old ladies on their way to what, you know,
cats and trees,
you know. And it's just kind of, it's the superhero as a local do-gooder at the same time as being the superhero as, you know, world-saving, you know, God. And I think the Zack Snyder films have very much emphasized the God angle, but they've sometimes forgotten about the cats and trees angle, which I think is very much part of Superman's small town, you know, American apple pie eating persona as well.
Gee Willikers.
And I think that's so important to have in there as well. I think you need the small town Kansas boy because I think he's essential to Superman, because otherwise you just have, you know, the version in Red Sun, who's amazing. It's an incredible comic book.
I love Red Sun. Like,
It's fantastic, but it's not the traditional Superman in the same way because he doesn't have that sense of small town Oshucks values and yet the vision to think globally as well.
If we're talking about representation as well, the Clark Kent side of that character, to have a white guy who's a journalist who wears glasses, the power that has, to see yourself on screen. I mean, I know he doesn't write about movies, but that's my guy.
I wondered where you were going with that. God.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you on Christopher Reeve being just peak Superman, and nobody's really, for me, come close since. And, you know, I've rewatched some clips of various Supermans in preparation for this. And when I watch Christopher Reeve, there's just something about his version of Superman. It's like, I immediately trust this guy. I immediately like this guy. There's a moral compass to this guy. I know that, you know, he's going to try and do the right thing. Nobody has really come close to that since. Because when I look at, you know, Man of Steel, which has a lot of really great moments, the moment when he first takes flight is a top five Superman moment for me. It's phenomenal. But I just think about, you know, his portrayal in Man of Steel and Batman v Superman, and I'm like, I don't even, you know, forget about trusting this guy. In Batman v Superman, I don't like this guy. You know, it's on that level. And then I think about, you know, what the fundamental core of Superman, and I, you know, a big part of that is the Kents raising, you know, Clark Kent and instilling him with those values. And then I think about the Kents in Man of Steel and Batman v Superman and what they say to Clark. And it's just, there's a reason why, you know, that's led to the Superman that we've gotten in those films. And it's just a shame to me because I think Henry Cavill, I said this before, I think he has in him a very good Superman movie if he just gets given a good script to work from. Unfortunately for me, it hasn't quite happened yet. And I know that we've spoken in the past about, you know, seeing Henry Cavill don, you know, the cape again for a future Superman movie. Even if by some miracle we get the Superman movie we want, I don't know how we reconcile that with what we've already seen from the character. It'll be very, very tricky.
I'm kind of hopeful. I'm intrigued to see what they do with the Snyder Cut, because I think in this iteration of Superman, the closest we've got to an actual sort of normal Superman, like getting to who that character is what they did when they, spoiler alert, brought him back to life at the end of Justice League. You saw just little hints there, more so than in previous DCEU films, of what Henry Cavill could do being a more hopeful version of that character. So I'm really intrigued, because so much of what it sounds like the final acts of Justice League are what's going to be significantly different. See what Zack Snyder had in store for him.
Yeah, I feel like the DCEU is maybe just like hand-waving a lot of the stuff they don't like anymore. I think that's what's happening a little bit with Wonder Woman, and I think you could probably do that with Superman as well. Cavill is, I've said it before, I think he can sometimes look smug, and I think Superman should never look smug, but at the same time, otherwise, I think he's a pretty good Superman. So if you just, you know, kept an eye out for the smug face, I think you'd be great. But mostly, you need a director who knows who Superman is, who likes Superman, who loves Superman even, and who really wants to get this guy who spends his entire life saving other people to the detriment of his own existence. That's the guy. That's who he is.
That's the massive thing that's missing from Man of Steel and Batman v Superman. Superman as a protector. For all of the issues Superman Returns has, Superman as protector is something that we get to see in that film. And that's a joyous thing every time it happens. Man of Steel, Batman v Superman, if your name is not Lois, good luck. So, yeah, that's something which, you know, Superman iterations must have. And I hope that in future we do get that, because he is a fantastic character. And if there was ever a time where we were in need of a great Superman movie, given what's happening in the world right now, now is the damn time. And I hate every time I read an article saying Warner Brothers saying, no, now is not the right time for a Superman movie because it might not work. It makes me want to hit a wall. It's complete ludicrousness every time I see that. This guy is an immigrant who's come to America to try and help. And look at the world today. It's annoying every time I hear that. So, you know, again, give me a good Superman movie and give it to me now, please.
Yeah, guys, those are really interesting points. I'd have to say that my favorite Superman movie is The Best of Superman. Otherwise known as Superman Returns, I guess.
No. It has its moments. It does it have really moments. Does.
It really does.
It's just not enough of them.
My thing with Superman Returns is that as much as I enjoy that film, most of its best moments are built on nostalgia for other moments in other films.
Yeah.
So I remember getting goosebumps whenever I saw it. The credits.
Incredible.
The Planet Krypton theme coming in, and you're going, oh my God, this is incredible. Singer has knocked it out of the park. And then the rest of the movie happens. And it's not that it's terrible. It's not terrible at all. But, you know, and the space shuttle sequence is incredible. But, you know, it's just not as good as what as the films it's trying to evoke, principally. Mm-hmm. Superman 1 and 2, which for me are still, you know, far and away.
Yep.
Unparalleled. But justice for Brandon Routh. I think he's he's excellent in the role. But yeah, there's no one can touch Chris Reeve. And I've said this before in the podcast, but I would hope that Henry Cavill gets a chance. Now that it seems like he is going to be Superman again, I would hope that he gets a chance to finally show what he can do in that role, because I think he has been super straitjacketed for about 3 movies now. But hey-ho. Moving on. That was Superman at number 9. At number 8, it's time for a 15-minute lecture from Helen on her favorite movie character of all time. Everyone turn off their microphones to let Helen take the floor on James Bond? Is that right? Am I pronouncing that right, Helen? James Bond?
James Bond. Yes.
James Boned. Yes, he did. Frequently. Yes, James Bond. Helen, do you have anything to say on this wonderful, groundbreaking, progressive character?
I mean, he has some good action sequences. And I'll leave it to you guys.
Oh, he also has some cracking theme tunes.
He does have a cracking theme tune. Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. Yeah.
Yeah.
And nice suits. Really good suits. I won't hear a word against his suits, except that safari suit.
Great. No, don't you diss a safari suit. Do not diss a safari suit. That safari suit that Roger Moore wears in Live and Let Die is perhaps the pinnacle of fashion in film. It's the moment at which everyone in every movie since should have just been Starkers, because you're just not going to top that. You're just not going to beat it. That's my opinion. So he has the best suits. He has the best gadgets.
Batman would like a word, but okay.
Does Batman have better gadgets than Bond?
It's an interesting discussion that would probably take more time than we have here.
He has got some wonderful toys.
Yeah, Where does he get those wonderful toys?
Hamleys. Yes, the Q branch floor of Hamleys.
Which it was in one, wasn't it? Yeah, it was in the one where Stephen Fry was R. Wasn't he in Hamleys?
Stephen Fry was R?
Wasn't Stephen Fry R? Am I making this up? John Cleese, shit. Yeah. Well done, me. But wasn't
you're just
Hamleys?
Confusing one tall Oxbridge-educated comedian with another one.
Yeah, they're all the same to me.
Oh my God. Back
but
to
Hamleys.
Bond. He has the best toy stores. He has the best suits. He has the best gadgets. He has the best one-liners. He has the best progressive politics that aren't rooted at all in the 1950s. Wow. He has the best stunts. Genuine argument to be made that the stunt in The Man with the Golden Gun, where the car does the corkscrew jump, albeit it's ruined by someone adding in post-production a whistle, literally as the car flips and does its jump, where the car literally goes boop. I mean, why would you add that? There's an argument to be made that that is the greatest stunt in the history of motion pictures. There's an argument to be made. But otherwise, I could take or leave him, really. What do you guys think?
No, Bond. I really like Bond. You know, there are a few heroes on this list who have been reinvented a whole bunch of times. But that doesn't happen unless the core tenets of the character remain cool and desirable for that amount of time. And as you alluded to, Chris, Bond is almost always the best dressed guy in the room. He's always the guy who gets the most beautiful woman. He's always the guy who gets to go to the coolest locations, the cool one-liners, the gadgets, the unflappableness on the... Chris is pointing to himself. Let the record reflect.
I mean, people see Bond films, they see escapism. I see a drudgery. I see my basic daily life replicated on the big screen, and it's so dull.
Yeah.
What I was going to say...
sorry.
...is that I think, you know, if you're a man of any age, it's hard not to look at a Bond film and think at some point, I want to be that guy, because he is the coolest guy. I think what makes him a hero, and John Nugent, who wrote the bit for this, says it in the mag, he always gets his man, which is probably the main reason why M and all the rest put up with him, because he goes against orders a lot in these movies. And a lot. I mean a lot. And, you know, it's because they know he's the best, and he knows they know he's the best, so he can get away with that a whole bunch.
I'm insufferable.
Helen is really loving this.
No, it's fine.
I think my favorite thing about James Bond is that the opening of Casino Royale with that parkour sequence, which is genuinely great, that's such an exciting action sequence, gave us the sequence in The Office where they're all running around shouting parkour, parkour, and trying to jump over sofas and jump into skips. So if for nothing else, James Bond is a hero for indirectly giving us one of the greatest moments in The Office.
I mean, that happens in a Harry Dresden book as well, though, where he's learning parkour and just keeps running around going parkour every time he jumps over something. Yeah, I mean, you know, he's very cool. He is just a figure of male wish fulfillment, I think. And that's both his strength and his weakness, I feel. And I realize that there have been attempts to inject depth and, you know, into the character over the years and with varying degrees of success. And I think that Daniel Craig in his better films has come closest to achieving that, but he's still not my favorite character, let's be honest.
Timbo Dalton would beg to differ.
Well, no, I would very much include Dalton in having done that.
Oh yeah, the boy Dalton, he's exceeded. Two films, knocked them both out of the park, and then dropped the mic. That is how you do it. Listen, you know, Bond has his issues, but I think he's undoubtedly a hero, even though he is a selfish snob, a Beatles-hating snob at the height of his Sean Connery powers. Oh, what a prick.
Killer.
There is. He's what?
He's a cold-blooded killer.
Yes, but he has a license, Helen. Oh, he has a license to kill. He even did a song about it, for goodness sake. it's all fine.
Did you know that in medieval times you could get a license to crenellate, which would allow you to put those big spiky bits on top of your castle? I want to see that as a Bond film. Anyway.
Crenellate is actually a great name for a Bond villain as well.
Right?
Yeah.
It could work so well.
I would be totally on board with that. Yeah, Bond's license to kill reminds me of... Bond's License to Kill reminds me of two great jokes about Frank Drebin in The Naked Gun. The first Naked Gun, where he retires from the force or is fired. I can't quite remember. And he's putting his gun on his desk and he says, just think, next time I shoot someone, I could get arrested. And the second one is when he is at the beginning of Naked Gun 2.5, when he is being he's been honored because he has just killed his 500th drug dealer. And he stands up and he goes, actually, I backed over the last two in my car. Luckily, they turned out to be drug dealers. Oh, dear. Anyway, just very, very quickly on Bond, because we're all clearly on the same page vis-a-vis the character. Who's your favorite Bond?
Ooh. Between Connery and Craig.
I think. Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I grew up on Brosnan, who does have his moments. But Craig, really, that balance between intensity and vulnerability that we were talking about, I think is great. And Casino Royale is my favorite Bond movie. He is amazing in that movie. And it really went into some unexpected places, but in a really good, satisfying way. I've rewatched it recently, and it's still very, very good. And I hope Craig leaves the franchise the way he entered it on a high.
Oh, fingers crossed. Wouldn't that be nice? Wouldn't that be nice? Because at the moment, he's two out of four. He's got 50% batting rate. Is that right, you say, in Spaceball? Wait, Spaceball? What the fuck is Spaceball? Yeah. Ben, where do you stand?
So I don't go super deep on Bonds. It's like not massively my area, but I have really enjoyed what Daniel Craig has done. And I think they've had some really sort of admirable attempts to, yeah, drag that character into to question some of those like unsavory things about him in these films. But having, like Amon, grown up on Pierce Brosnan, I'm kind of ready for a lighter Bond again. Like, I do want the Craig era to go out on a high, but I'd like a little bit more fun and a little bit more camp back in that world now. So that's kind of where I hope it goes next. But yeah, I do really like the Craig Bond.
I miss the gadgets.
And yeah, actual gadgets, not just like, this gun only shoots for you, which is why you can't wear these gloves in this fight scene.
I tend to think that Dalton is the best in terms of just bringing the character on the page to life, and not going too far from that. Because I think Craig has really rooted in the books, but then tried to add some modern psychology. And I think the others, at times at least, went off in completely crazy other directions. But yeah, I think I like Dalton.
Dalton tried in a way, I think, and had Dalton made more than two Bond films, I think we would probably, had Dalton made GoldenEye, for example, I think we'd be talking about him as undisputedly the best. But he wasn't helped by the fact that there was a 6-year gap, and then during that time, you know, both he and Ian decided to go their separate ways. But had he made, say, GoldenEye or another film immediately after License to Kill, I think we'd be talking about him as the best one. And he might have even prefigured Craig in terms of introducing an arc to the character. That's one thing that, you know, the Craig Bond has on the other ones. You know, there's obviously loose continuity with all the Bonds until they reboot it with Craig, you know, so you get the references to the Dalton and the Brosnan Bonds, both referring to their wife,
the,
you know,
the
Lazenby, the Lazenby Bond married when he married Diana Rigg. But it was a very, very loose continuity. And you got the sense that Connery and Moore just didn't give a shit about that, about the general arc of the character. And I mean that in the best possible way. And I love them both, you know, immensely. But, you know, for them, each Bond was a reset button being hit. And Dalton changed that. And also, I think his films, you know, he perhaps wasn't the best at the quips and the one-liners, but License to Kill is, for me, the best Bond film. I've said that already on the record. There you go. I'm saying it again. Dalton's the best. License to Kill's the best. James Bond is the best. Why was James Bond not a 007 on this list? Why is he a 008?
Hey.
This is bullshit. Anyway, at 007 is Leia Organa, Princess Leia, a.k.a. General Leia.
Correct.
Yeah.
I mean, look, Okay, I've said this in the magazine years ago, and I'm going to repeat myself, but it's an interesting role in that first trilogy, especially because what you have in that series of films is a series of codependent male pairs, Han and Chewie, Luke and Obi-Wan, the Emperor and Darth Vader, C-3PO and R2-D2, who are at least male-coded, even if they're not technically male. You needed a woman as a beard, basically, because otherwise it would have been the campest film ever instead of like 17th campest. And single-handedly, Carrie Fisher, you know, drops it down that list by being like super, super cool. You know, when have you ever seen a rescue attempt like that one in the first film where she basically just gives her rescuers shit nonstop for the whole rest of the film, for the quality of their rescue.
And ungrateful, she's just, Helen, is what I would say. Ungrateful.
Yeah, she is. Well, there is an element of ingratitude, but there's also an element of, for God's sake, I could have done this better myself. I was thinking of a way out. Just give me a minute.
Oh, in your own time, Your Highness.
well, okay, Han, but you know, I love her for that. I love her lack of deference, really, to anyone. I love the fact that it doesn't come across so much as spoiled princess as it does hyper competent leader who has no time for your shit. And I just adore her. She is my role model in life and everything. And yeah. And she can rock a white dress. I mean, they rescue her from prison and her dress is still white. Is that made of the same stuff as the suit in The Man in the White Suit? How is that even possible? Doesn't make any sense. I love it.
Yeah. I love how she changes her accent. So, you know, she's got this kind of, you know, kind of posh American accent going on. But then when she's talking to, you know, Darth Vader in A New Hope, she's like, Darth Vader, only you could be so bold. You know, it's like, what's going on with that?
I don't think she knows what was going on with her accent, to be honest. She's been pretty clear about that ever since.
I thought I detected your foul stench when I was brought on board. You know, it's a little bit like that, isn't it? But yeah, she's great. She's absolutely wonderful. And she brings a real soupçon of personality to a film. Mm. You know, because Luke, you know, we'll talk about Luke in a couple of minutes, but Luke, especially in New Hope, is, yeah, spoiler, Luke is a whiny shithead, and she's great, and she just deals with it and deals with his bullshit, and you can see why she's paired up with Han Solo. She's higher than Han Solo in this list. Ha ha! Yeah, take that. Take
damn
that.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, this is probably why the marriage fell apart, to be honest.
he couldn't handle someone else being cooler than him. I really like as well. Allow me then to now bang the drum for the sequel trilogy. Obviously, I think we all wish that there was more Leia in the sequel trilogy. Obviously, they had big plans for that character for episode 9 that then... with Carrie Fisher obviously sadly passing away, they couldn't lean into. But even in the performances that she did give, I love how they evolved that character and, yeah, made her a general. It felt very, very fitting. I don't think it was massively successful at this, but I liked that they at least explored her force sensitivity, because that's just dropped in at the end of Return of the Jedi and they never really get to explore it. So I think I sort of give them credit for even, exploring the side of it that she has. She's force sensitive too, and she has abilities, and that even despite that, she's chosen her own path of becoming a general in the resistance. She's just great. And like just seeing Carrie Fisher back in that role, and seeing her and Han sort of reuniting is beautiful. I love it.
Mm. It was the best kind of fan service. Yeah,
There's lots of different kinds of heroism in Star Wars, but hers, I think, is the most reliable. She's a Star Wars hero you can rely on the most. You think about Han, as much as I love him, he's flaky. You think about even Luke in The Last Jedi, he has his moments of sort of doubt, and obviously that's part of his journey, which I really, really enjoy, but it did happen. You think about Leia, it doesn't matter how bad things are, it doesn't matter who or what she's lost, she can always be counted on to do the right thing for the Resistance, and to do it while remaining cool, calm, and collected most of the time. That's leadership. That's heroism. That's why she's number 7 on the list.
She also has so much compassion. Like, Luke's just lost his mentor of a few days, let's be honest, and she's comforting him. She's just lost her freaking planet, dude. She's the one comforting him.
She didn't know everyone on that planet.
I'm going to go ahead and say she knew more than one person and for longer than a few days, Chris.
Yeah, but they were all dickheads.
Oh my God. All we know of Alderaan is that they were nice people.
No, but all dickheads is what you call people from Alderaan. All dickheads. Uh-huh. It's canon. She's awesome. She's awesome. She's so awesome she could withstand being in that gold bikini, which could have sunk that character, but really didn't.
I mean, even then you get the image of her literally strangling Jabba in the chains that he tried to capture her in. So that's a pretty badass sort of image
metaphor.
As well.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Metaphor.
Strangled patriarchy with its own chains. There you go.
So there we go. Princess General Leia Organa /Solo/Skywalker, whatever you want to call her, is at number 7. At number 6, he's a billionaire, genius, playboy, philanthropist, who likes to dress up in a costume and fight evil. It is, of course, Bruce Wayne, a.k.a. Batman. Why did you think I was talking about someone else? Batman is at number 6. And I think we've got to feel we've talked about Batman. What the hell was that?
Whoa! It's my favourite.
Sorry, that was me. Okay.
Helen, I thought you didn't do impressions. Sorry, my throat was sore.
And you'll never have to.
Love it.
Of course, we're mainly talking about the Will Arnett Lego Batman, right?
Yes,
the best Batman.
Let me just set everything we're about to say up by saying this: there is no one Batman. There is no right or wrong Batman. The Adam West Batman is absolutely no. I'm not even Kevin Conroy. I'm on. I know where you're going with this. The Adam West Batman is absolutely as canonical as the Dark Knight Batman, as the Batman v Superman Batman, as the Lego Batman, as the Keaton Batman, as the Kevin Conroy Batman. There is no one right Batman because it is a character that has just this small core of basic facts, and then you can do whatever the heck you want with him. And that includes the campy version, and that includes the ultra serious, boring version. Sorry, brooding version. And that's the glory of Batman, I guess. Now I am on. You can explain why I'm wrong and why it's Kevin Conroy. Go on.
Well, oh, wow. The Batman v Superman Batman is not a Batman that I recognize to me, because once you start killing people, then you're not Batman. And to me, I've said this before, he's in that movie, it's the Punisher in a bat suit. That is what he is. And that, to me, you know, I can be here for like 30 minutes and talk about all the ways that interpretation pissed me off, but I'm not going to do that. Instead, I'm going to talk about why Kevin Conroy is the best Batman. And by the way, this is another thing I need to take up with Empire Editorial. The one Batman who should definitely be part of this is not included. What's going on? Do I need to come over there and have a talk with somebody? This is ridiculous. But anyway, Kevin Conroy, Batman.
Swear Batman. To me.
I'm on. Pops into the Empire offices.
Where are you?
Here.
Just might do that.
Well, the problem is, Amon, if you came into the Empire offices right now, you would they'd be empty. There would be no one there. Yeah, so you're going to come to everyone's houses, and I advise against it. but yes, that's Kevin Conroy is great, isn't he? He's awesome.
Yeah.
We love Kevin Conroy.
Whenever I read the comics, it's his voice that I sort of hear in my head when I read the comics, and that will never change. It's the Batman that I grew up with, and that interpretation of the Batman animated series, which went on to Justice League, is everything you want to see from Batman in terms of he is the smartest guy in the room. He is the Dark Knight detective. He is the master of cool gadgetry with non-lethal combat. And we haven't really seen that combination of things, which for me sort of are very, very important in a depiction of Batman. I haven't seen that combination of things in as potent a way as we do in those animated series. I think for me, Justice League, the animated series, is the best super animated series of all time. And it's one of the reasons why I get frustrated when I look back at the first three movies in the DCEU, because I know what that had the potential to be. If you go back and watch this animated series, and I've tried to get Helen to do this to no success.
I'm just busy with stuff.
It's okay. You're writing the book. It's fine, you know, but afterwards we need to talk.
But the
relationship that Batman has with Superman, for instance, in that show is just phenomenal, and these guys should be the best of friends in the live action. I'm getting to Batman v Superman again. I don't want to do that, but Kevin Conroy is just fantastic. And I watched this documentary, which is now on YouTube, called The Heart of Batman recently, which, you know, they go through the entire history of the birth of that animated series. There's a reason why it's still regarded as like one of, if not the best, to the super animated show of all time. And the combination of the people who are working behind the scenes and the people who were voicing those characters made that show into what it is. And Kevin Conroy is a massive part of that. He is, for me, my Batman. And again, he should be, you know, just take out Michael Keaton, take out Christian Bale, just have Kevin Conroy Batman as a picture.
Back the fuck up.
I like those guys, believe me. Batman Begins is great. Dark Knight is great. Batman Begins, I've said this before, has the greatest super ending to a super film ever, in my opinion. I think the final minute of that film is exceptional. No, I'm sorry. The final minute of Batman Begins is better than the final minute of Endgame.
Wow, is this Amon Says Wrong Things Day? What, I just want to see. Can you show me your calendar? I want to see if you've got something circled.
I got the mic in my hand and I'm dropping it. There you go.
Just that. Really? So many things I have to fight against.
Some men just want to watch the world burn, Chris.
But I love them all. Superheroes are great. Endgame is great. Michael Keaton is great. Christian Bale is great. It's just that Kevin Conroy is better. I'm done.
Feels like you have turned on yourself. It's just like seconds ago. You were about to throw Michael Keaton off a fucking building. Now you're saying he's great. What's going on?
There's no point throwing him off a building. He would just fly down, wouldn't he? He'd like, he'd use his cloak and like click out the wings and he'd be fine.
Quick question here. Doesn't the Michael Keaton Batman, which is, I love that Batman. I love those two Batman films. But doesn't he kill people as well? I'm pretty sure he does.
He does, yeah.
But there's a difference between, you know, when he, like, Batman v Superman takes it to just a whole... The guy is machine gunning. He's ramming the Batmobile into people's heads.
In that he's a Batmaniac. Yeah.
So there's different formulations of Batman's one rule, and it's either doesn't kill or doesn't use guns. But either way, Batman v Superman definitely breaks it. Whereas with most of the other Batmans, there's at least a little bit of wiggle room on whether he breaks it or not. But I think, because they weren't so concerned with canon and the rules back in the 80s and 90s. So he does, the Keaton Batman doesn't entirely... conform to the rule either.
I think Helen's point of wiggle room, I think he's always basically been a psychopath and he's been in complete denial about. It's like, dude, you drop this guy off a building or you like, you've given this person PTSD and he just doesn't care. He doesn't give a shit.
This is my big problem with Batman, as you know, is like, I find it hypocritical that the one rule makes no sense, basically. But there is a rule. There should be a rule that he follows and he can make sense of, even if I can't as a lawyer, because it doesn't make any sense in law, but you know, fine.
I mean I do totally agree with what Helen was saying about it shows the strength of the character that you can project as many different tones and shades onto Batman and it works in all senses, and there is a lot of love for everything from the campier side of Batman to even the within the darker representations of Batman. You have the super serious real world Nolanization. You also have the really sort of eerie, gothic, heightened dark Batman in Tim Burton's Superman and in bits of the animated series and comics. And I think it's just a really interesting canvas to be able to project a lot of things onto while still having a core of this damaged person who is trying to overcome their damage by trying to fill a void that they can never fill, I think is a really interesting idea. And to take that quite bleak notion and make him heroic is a tricky balancing act, but I think it really works.
I'm interested to see what happens in The Batman as well. I feel like that's... we haven't really seen the great detective aspect particularly played on screen, apart from a few scenes in the Keaton movies. And it would be really nice, I think, to see that developed. So I'm excited.
Yeah, I remember asking Chris Nolan about this because I spoke to him just ahead of Batman Begins and he said, oh, no, there's definitely going to be a detective element. I don't remember it. But, you know, that would be nice. Something new. But, you know, your Batman, you're absolutely right. He reflects the concerns of the people who direct him, of his directors. He also reflects, I think, the time in which that particular film is made or that particular creation. You know, Frank Miller's Batman is very different from the Adam West Batman. It's very different from the Christopher Nolan Batman. So I'm excited about that. I'm going to say best Bruce Wayne on screen. We're discounting Kevin Conroy. Yes, I know Mask of the Phantasm got a release, but we're discounting it for the time being.
Thank you for at least acknowledging it. Thank you.
we're going to discount that. We're going to stick to live action Batman only, okay? Best Bruce Wayne, Michael Keaton. Best Batman... Christian Bale.
Yeah.
I'll accept that.
I don't particularly like a lot of what happens in those movies, but Affleck does a good job in nailing the physicality of the character and the look of the character and the mood of the character.
Ben Affleck is not the problem with those movies.
Yeah.
True. Anyway, now we move into the top five. Luke Skywalker. The rise of Skywalker has stopped at number five. No further for Luke Skywalker. What's your take on this beloved character?
In terms of character arc, there can't be very many people on this list who have a bigger one. I feel like Luke Skywalker starts off as this absolutely, I mean, not to say cardboard cutout, because I think that's a bit harsh, but he's very much the archetype of the naive farm boy, the enthusiast, the youngster, who is all good intentions and absolutely no experience and knowledge. And that's his starting point. And we've seen it a million times. Deliberately so. It was based on, you know, The Hero with 1,000 Faces by Joseph Campbell and all the rest. So it's deliberately set up as an archetype. But what he goes through and what he learns about himself, about his family, about his destiny or lack thereof, about the power that he has or doesn't have, I think is one of the most interesting arcs here. And the fact that he fails spectacularly with the next generation, the fact that he doesn't know how to deal with it, the fact that he cuts himself off from the single thing he's spent his whole life looking for as a sort of penance and a sort of, you know, I don't know, self-castigation kind of technique. I think he is incredible. And I all credit to Mark Hamill, who I think was given a lot of room to play with in the sequels and really kind of went for it. I think he brought everything he's learned about acting in the many years since and kind of put it into that character. And I love him in that. I absolutely love him in Last Jedi and Rise of Skywalker. I just think he's so much more fun, much more interesting. But the seeds were so, and they are there in the original trilogy as well. And I think that's what's great, is that you can see these little bits of darkness, the struggle that Luke has once he gets past mere enthusiasm and gets into actual knowledge and getting closer to power. He has to deal with stuff. And I think that's why it works so well when you see him really, really struggling, you know, 30 years later.
Yeah, I mean, I'll back you up there, especially the way they take that character in The Last Jedi. I understand that some people still just don't like that interpretation, but I think it makes him so much more interesting to have this character who is heroic and who has had this past legacy of amazing sort of acts of heroism still in later life, having these really complicated feelings to deal with and having to deal with his own shame and wanting to hide away. And I think the way that they bring him back, the way that he enters the fray at the end, it gives you exactly what you want. It gives you the badass Luke when he force projects onto Crate and faces down the First Order. It gives you that legend that you want to see, but also that character like knowing the role that he can play, knowing that the best thing he can do is stall and give time instead of rushing in and like dying on the battlefield instantly. It's smart and it shows evolution in that character. It shows growth and the growth that he gets through interacting with Rey. And I absolutely love that interpretation. I think it's amazing. And like you said, the arc of where he begins, there's a real joy and there's a real just pure wish fulfillment to the farm boy from nowhere who's looking up at the sky dreaming of this bigger destiny and finding out that he can have that. All the darkness that he goes through in the original trilogy, I think, just makes that such an interesting journey for him. And yeah, I love Luke Skywalker. I think he's amazing.
Yeah Now you guys have said all. It's really, we don't really get to see, there's not many heroes on this list who are flawed and get to fight through that to something sort of better on the other side. But when it's done in the way such as Luke, it makes it all the more satisfying sort of watching that journey take place. And you think about not only with the revelation of Darth Vader and then him having to sort of fight through that to turn him towards the light. But then you think about what they did with The Last Jedi and having that flaw be, you know, even more explicit and having to fight through it again in a really satisfying way. And that's a really enjoyable journey to watch. I really like the character.
I not to bang on about The Last Jedi too much, but I think potentially my favorite scene in maybe all of Star Wars is the Luke and Yoda scene in The Last Jedi. I think that is just absolutely beautiful. And the conversation that those two have as different generations of Jedi, as a conversation across generations, across years of knowledge and experience accrued, both having been mentors to younger Jedi and seeing what that means and thinking about their legacy and the legacy of the Jedi Order, that whole notion of we are what they grow beyond, that is the true burden of all masters, I think is absolutely fucking amazing. I think there's just a real depth to that conversation, and that comes so much from Luke and from everything that Luke has gone through, and it's just beautiful.
You've all nailed it there, pretty much. He's great. The deepening of the character, the shades that Hamill is allowed to introduce, you know, I think informed in part by stuff he went on in his the stuff went on in his own personal life as well, you know, between New Hope and Empire, and it's really interesting, you know, the Vader Luke stuff at the end of Empire and the Vader Emperor Luke stuff at the end of Return of the Jedi is wonderful, complex and interesting and even moving if you want to go in that direction. And yeah, I'm also on board with The Last Jedi. I think it's great. And the people who wanted to see, you know, listen, I think Rian Johnson did the best, especially with what the hand he was dealt by J.J. Abrams, whose decision to leave Luke out of The Force Awakens is still one that I don't entirely agree with. He's it's a wonderful character, and Hamill, it's great to see him getting this kind of second career. I mean, he had this side career as a great voice actor, but it's great to see him being recognized now and getting to do stuff worthy of his talents. Okay, into the top four now. Number four, Captain America. Is that? Does that ring a bell with anybody? I don't think it rings
a
bell
sound
with
familiar.
With me.
Yeah, there's definitely a sense of familiarity there. No, look.
No, Luke was number five.
This guy's just the best. I love him, as we all know, but it is because, and I think what they did really well in those films is that they showed it isn't easy being good
being green.
Or green, as we know from The Muppets. But yeah, it's not an easy thing. You know, you can have the best moral compass in the world and your life is still going to be shit. And I think that's what is so good about Steve Rogers is that he really, really struggles and he unfailingly still does what he thinks is right and what he thinks is best. And it's just kind of miraculous to see that, because I'm so bored, with all due respect to all the Batmans, I'm so bored of the brooding endlessly. And I just want to see someone who knows what the right thing is and does it and puts up with the consequences, however bad they are. And like, Steve has had an objectively dreadful life, like a childhood absolutely dominated by one illness after another. Lost his father, in infancy, if I recall correctly, his mother as a youth, basically brought up by his best mate and their parents, literally newspaper in his shoes because they couldn't afford anything else, probably hungry half the time, certainly sick most of the time, obviously, as we've said, wanted to, you know, do the right thing, stand up to bullies, help out his country in need, couldn't do any of that because he was just pathetic. And even when he gets the chance, you know, things immediately go wrong for him, and continue to go wrong basically through his entire existence that we know of. If anyone ever deserved a happy ending and a nice, you know, dance around to some 40s music, it's definitely Steve Rogers. So I just love him. I just think I don't think that a lack of moral clarity is necessarily a good character trait for the stories that we tell ourselves endlessly. I don't think we always need to say, oh, it's more complicated than that, because sometimes it isn't. And I think sometimes we do ourselves as a society, as a civilization, a disservice in pretending that there's no such thing as right and wrong, because sometimes there is. And so I kind of like that there's Steve Rogers out there.
It's definitely one of the problems with the Cavill Superman.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Just be a good guy, you know?
Absolutely. Just plant your feet and look the other person in the eye and tell the truth.
Unless, of course, you
obfuscate the truth about the death of someone's parents.
Oh, I mean, you could do that. He was trying to do the right thing. Even there, he's trying to protect everybody.
He's worthy.
He is worthy.
We're not the arbiters of whether or not Steve Rogers is worthy, right?
Exactly.
Mjolnir is the arbiter of whether Steve Rogers is worthy, and it finds him worthy. So,
correct.
Therefore, I'm going to to stand back from this one. Steve and Tony buried a hatchet. I think at the moment when, you know...
No, Thor has the hatchet.
I think at the moment when Steve and Tony shake hands and resentment is corrosive and all that sort of stuff, that's the point where Mjolnir goes, ooh, hello. And even then, Mjolnir begins twitching. Yeah, it's just flying through time and space. Where is he now? He's 1970 New Jersey. I can't possibly go there. Yeah. Listen, I love this character as well. This would have been absolutely possibly the easiest character to fuck up in the mm-hmm. early days of the MCU.
Sure. For sure.
And there's so much riding on getting Thor right. There's so much riding that they got Tony right. No question about that, as we'll discuss in a second.
Spoiler.
And you know they got Thor right, but you're absolutely right. Cap could have been bland. He could have been boring. He could have been one note. And I think these were concerns that Chris Evans had when he took on the role as well. But he was steered right by Marcus McFeely, the guys who, more than anyone else, I think, in the MCU, were able to take a single character and plot his journey all the way through, from First Avenger all the way to Endgame. And, of course, aided in that by the Russos. I was thinking the other day, I don't know whether we give the Russos and Marcus McFeely and Feige and all the team at Marvel, and I know that, you know, people still look down their noses at the MCU, still. We don't. This is a safe space for fans of the biggest franchise in movie history. We're all good. But think about this. I texted you, Helen, the other day with this, going, the Russos directed in a 5-year period Winter Soldier, Civil War, Infinity War, and Endgame. And not only didn't fuck any of them up, made arguably 4 of the greatest blockbusters of all time in a row without stopping. That's incredible. And that's the heart of those movies, the exception maybe of Infinity War, is Steve Rogers.
Some absolute galaxy brain shit right there. That's insane.
It's mind-blowing.
It's crazy, isn't it? I think they got Cap right from the beginning, like that scene in First Avenger where before he's even bulked up, when he's still skinny, scrawny Steve, and he jumps on the grenade, like right from that moment, you know they've got that character down. And I think what you were saying, they did exactly the right thing in not complicating the character, not trying to make the character murky, but taking a sort of very clean, optimistic character and putting him in a murky world is a much more interesting way to go. And I think they did that brilliantly, especially in Winter Soldier and Civil War, where, taking somebody who is so clean cut and sticking him in a world where nothing is quite as simple as it was when from the time that he grew up in, I think is a really smart way to go. And it allows you to do so many interesting things with that character without compromising the authentic core of who he is. And Chris Evans plays all of those shades so well.
So well. Yeah. I would slightly argue with you on one, or disagree with you on one thing, which is I'm not sure he's necessarily optimistic always, weirdly. I feel like he's experienced too much reality to be entirely, he's definitely, he hopes, I think, for the best, and he tries to do the best. I'm not sure he's kind of optimistic in the traditional sense, certainly not in the wide-eyed sense that someone like Luke is. And while he's clean cut, he's, you know, there's none of the sort of Batman one rule here. He will absolutely kill you if he has to. He hopes he doesn't have to, but he will absolutely kill you if he has to.
I mean, in terms of an action hero as well, I really like the fact that within the superhero genre, obviously he's got super strength, but he is also still just a man. He can't fly. Yeah. And so from a pure action perspective, what makes especially Winter Soldier and Civil War so great is the fight scenes in that, having him obviously be stronger than a normal man, but like the corridor fight scenes and him like jumping across rooftops and all of that stuff is so exciting. And he's a very human character to root for because, like, you know, he can withstand a real beating, but he feels vulnerable in a way that some of the other superheroes don't.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, Winter Soldier is when they figured out how to make Cap look cool in action. From that very opening sequence on the Lemurian Star, it's like, okay, this is a bit different and I like it a lot. And they sort of took it and ran with it through the entire rest of his appearances in a really big way. But yeah, no, I agree with everything that you said. I think when it comes to the whole morally uncomplicated heroes are not boring, example one for that argument is Steve Rogers in the MCU, and in a really big way. And I love how, as sort of he gets brought into modern day, and I've said this before, but I love seeing good leadership on screen. And Cap is one of the maybe handful of characters who I would follow in battle.
Mm-hmm.
No questions asked. If Cap is leading you, I want to be right by his side. I mean, he's too far, so you know he'll outrun me. But you know, I'll be running. I'll be running right behind him. Yeah, I'll be like, you go, Steve. I'll catch up. It's fine. It's fine. But yeah, he's great. And you think about the character arcs of all these people on this list. I don't know if anybody has the character arc that Steve Rogers had. Think about it, from a scrawny kid in Brooklyn to wielding the power of the gods and leading the greatest army the universe has ever seen into battle. I mean, it doesn't get much better than that. And it's an awesome journey. I feel lucky that I've sort of been able to sort of watch him get progressively sort of more better and more interesting, and just yeah. It's hard not to fall in love with that character over the 10 years that we've seen him.
Why bother?
don't fight it, Amon. Futile. Don't fight it. Especially with that beard, my word.
Oh, good. No, Lord.
But Sharon Carter's not appearing in this podcast.
Hey.
I've spoken about this before, but along with Helen, there's a friend we have called Lamara. And she is like, it's like I have my own personal Chris Evans Google alert with Lamara. It's great. And I've now grown accustomed to just, you know, every couple of days I'll get sent with Chris Evans with a beard. I mean, it's hard to sort of, you know, feel good about yourself sometimes when you just get a constant stream of Chris Evans pics to your phone. But, you know, it's okay. I live with it. It's fine.
Mm. I know. It's like the whether it's him holding the helicopter in Civil War or ripping the log, which is not a technical term, in Age of Ultron. He's almost like he and Hemsworth have been put in this earth to make the rest of us feel bad about ourselves. And it's horrible.
And yet we love them. We love them.
I can't stay mad at a Chris. I just can't. I can't do it. But yeah, he's just great. And you know, the fact that Tony defers to him is really telling about, you know, the moxie that he has. And there's just so many moments that are just great. The moment in Avengers when the sort of the two cops, one of whom I think winds up an Agent Carter, actually, doesn't he? The two cops are like, oh, why should we listen to you? And then suddenly, you know, Steve's bashing Chitauri all over the place, and they're like, they immediately implement his orders. That's great. There's so much.
I rewatched Avengers recently, and I think it's the one film where they don't 100% get Cap. He's a lot straighter laced there than he will be in any other film. And obviously that was Joss Whedon, who I think is great usually, but I think that's the one bit where Cap isn't 100% in that film. Looking back, he's still great.
I was going to say, that scene you were talking about, Chris, with the cops, it's a perfect example of Cap, and in terms of when you're around him, you want to be better. And it happens with numerous guys. It happens with Tony. It happens with Black Widow, Winter Soldier. It happens with Scarlet Witch in Civil War. When you're around this guy, you want to be a better person. And that's, you know, again, an example of great leadership.
Even when he's lying about someone's parent's death, it's incredible. You just want to get behind this guy. You just want to throw your weight behind him. But listen, we could talk about Steve Rogers all day, but we have to move into the top three. And in third place, well, I think even Steve would go, fair play, well done.
Only because he's
Tony
modest.
Stark. Tony Stark, a.k.a. the Invincible, although all recently all too invincible, Iron Man.
I mean, it took a literally cosmic force, Chris, so I think that it's okay to be invincible by that, really.
What a loser. Yeah.
I think, look, again, this is a character with a great character arc, and while he didn't have the advantage of having more or less the same writers almost entirely through his MCU journey, what they did have was Robert Downey Jr. himself looking out for that character, fighting that character's corner, literally suggesting lines, literally, you know, commenting on dialogue, feeding back, making sure that the Tony Stark that we see was a sort of coherent character the whole way through. And full credit to him. It's an astonishing piece of casting and an astonishing case of a guy just being right for a part and then shaping that part so he continues to be right for it. But I think Tony's journey is, you know, it's the typical kind of, you know, absolutely self-obsessed narcissist, you know, wakes up to a wider world and maybe becomes a slightly better person. But it's such a kind of halting journey, and he still retains so much narcissism. I say this with love, that it just works. And it kind of reminds us that, you know, while we may not all have the innate moral compass of Steve Rogers, we can all try and be a little bit better people. And there's nobility there as well. There's something good about having these characters who are incredibly flawed, like deeply, fundamentally flawed people, who can also, you know, step up when the occasion demands it and make the sacrifice play, as it turns out, on more than one occasion.
I think he really changed what like superheroes could be on screen as well. If you think back to 2008, everything we'd seen was, I don't know, it was alter egos. It was having to hide your true identity, and him coming out at the end of the first Iron Man and saying, "I am Iron Man," was such a game changer. And I think they really kept that swagger and that cool and that arrogance that kind of makes him so dickishly likable. They kept that even as they made him a better person, which I think is a really, really tricky line to balance. But they did that. And so much of that is down to Robert Downey Jr., who's amazing.
Yeah, he's fantastic. I don't think enough is talked about in terms of the super climate in those days. You had Batman, you had The Dark Knight coming out that same year. And Batman might be the most popular super of all time. It's number one and two between him and Superman. So to have Iron Man come in and really give supers more lightness than they've had, than they had had for a while at that time, and to really sort of, I mean, granted it came out a couple months before The Dark Knight, but to do that in a year where a film like that is coming out, I think is really exceptional. And again, as you say, a lot of it is down to Robert Downey Jr. in ways that were both immediately apparent and became sort of, you know, more apparent in the years to come, in the appearances to come. And ending that character got in Endgame is just absolutely perfect.
But you're right, it's lightness, but not the sort of comic tone that we'd seen from superheroes in the past. Like, in the past, there'd been the dark superheroes, the sort of Blades and maybe the X-Men, and then there'd been the crazy poppy, you know, Batman and Robins. Mm-hmm. And I think what Iron Man found was really a third way between those. And again, full credit, not just to Robert Downey Jr., but of course, Jon Favreau for doing that as well, who I think did a magnificent job with that film.
Yeah, and also it's interesting to note that, you know, he's not just glib man constantly over that, you know, 11-year period from Iron Man to Endgame, that he really does grow and deepen as a character, and, you know, and he really does display depths of emotion. The Tony of Civil War is very, very different from the Tony we meet in Iron Man. And I love the Tony of Endgame as well, who is finally reached a moment of in his life of calm and zen and peace, and, you know, he's happy to lay it all on the line one last time. You know, I think if they didn't get that casting right, if they had cast anyone else, whether it was Cage or Sam Rockwell, you know, or Tom Cruise as Tony Stark, I don't think we're talking about the MCU in terms of his magnitude as we are now. I think that's lightning in a bottle. I think the casting in most cases in the MCU is absolutely spot on. I struggle to think of anyone else who could have played Thor. I struggle to think of anyone else who could have played Steve Rogers. But it's Tony who started it all. It's Robert Downey Jr. who started it all, and he's incredible. And, you know, I still worry, because this sort of thing that keeps me awake at night, how the MCU is going to fare without Downey and without Tony Stark and without Steve Rogers, of course. But Tony in particular is, I think, the glue that held the MCU together. If Steve's the soul, Tony's the glue, and he's a wonderful, wonderful character.
The MCU, of course, in this scenario is Pinocchio. Has glue and a soul.
He's a real boy. He's a real boy. The MCU is a real boy. Who knows? I don't know what I'm saying, Helen, but yes, he's absolutely phenomenal.
Black Panther 2 is coming out. The MCU will be fine. Don't worry.
Yeah, exactly.
Wakanda's got this.
There you know.
Wakanda's got this. It's all good.
T'Challa has us. T'Challa has us. Peter Parker. Carol Danvers. Yeah, they're all great characters, but you know, let's see how things go. I hope you're right. All right, at number two on the list, it is Sigourney Weaver as Ripley.
Yeah, no, this is right. Okay, can I just take a moment here to very quickly point out that there's only 14 women on the list. That reflects, I think, cinema, not our voters particularly. And Ripley is always a fixture on these lists, and she's generally the highest placed women. And that's not great given that she came, you know, about in 1979.
Yep.
So we need to do better, people. But anyway, but she is great, and she does deserve a high place on these lists. And I think it's interesting that she was almost a Trojan horse in that first film. She wasn't the advertised lead. She wasn't the highest profile cast member. She was barely known. And the film only very gradually comes to sort of really focus on her. It's not clear that she's our heroine. It's not clear that she's the last girl or that it will be a last girl at all. If you were putting money going into that film, you would say it's going to be the captain. Obviously, everybody else is, you know, anyone else who survives is going to survive because he protects them. And I think that's what's great. She kind of sneaks up on us. She sneaks up in our affections and sort of wins her place through sheer endurance and sheer grit. And then in Aliens, which is my personal favorite of the franchise, I'm sure like many people, I can appreciate Alien. I really, really appreciate Alien, but I love Aliens.
Both are masterpieces, but Aliens is masterpiecier.
I'm not getting into that debate either. But I do think that Aliens is a more fun watch, certainly. And part of the reason it's more fun is you've got Ripley as a sort of Cassandra figure in that film. She's the one kind of ringing the bell and telling people that they need to be worried, that there is a problem that they need to face, and being consistently ignored, except by Hicks in one of the sexiest lines in movie history. So It's just great to see that kind of evolution, and the fact that when she realizes that no one is going to help her take care of this problem that she identifies, she just does it herself and she does whatever needs to be done. So she's never someone who goes out looking for trouble, but she is absolutely someone who won't run from trouble when she finds it. And I think that's what's so great about her.
Well said. Although I would say, of course, that the Trojan horse in Alien, Helen, is Kane.
Literally, figuratively,
you know. I think the seeds of what Helen was saying about the fact that she is ignored by everyone around her while she clearly knows what's going on, I like that the seeds of that kind of are there in the first one as well, because she's the one who's saying, don't break quarantine, we can't let this guy back on the ship. And I like that you don't notice it the first time around because it starts as an ensemble movie, that when you revisit Alien, Ripley versus Ash there sort of meddling behind the scenes, trying to make sure that the sample comes aboard and all of that. You see that she's skeptical of that the whole way along, even if you don't really notice it at first, because you're just dealing with the information as it comes. So I think it's really nicely layered in there that she has a sense of what's right and what's the smart choice, even though, the complications around it, the situation around it is complicated.
Now, she's a fantastic hero, and I just think over the years when I read about strong female characters, there's a number of people sort of who always tie it back to Ripley, because in many ways she was one of, if not the first, in that kind of, just in terms of being a female badass we haven't really sort of seen on screen at that point. And that's an amazing legacy to have.
Yeah.
Really is. And Sigourney Weaver is phenomenal.
Incredible.
In the role. I think most people would vote for her on this list based on Alien and Aliens, but she's equally impressive in Alien 3 and Alien Resurrection, where, of course, she made that once-in-a-lifetime basketball shot. So maybe for that alone, she should be number two on this list. But yeah, it's Aliens, and it's her relationship with Newt and the way that her, as Cameron and Sigourney Weaver laid out, the way her mothering instinct kicks in emphatic fashion towards the end of that movie, that is incredible. So yes, indeed, well deserved. And that brings us now to the number one choice in the list. Who could it be? Drum roll, please, everybody. It's pathetic. It's terrible. Stop it. Stop it immediately. It is, of course, at number one, Henry Jones Jr.
Junior.
Possessor of the greatest theme in movie history.
I mean, that's a whole other podcast, Chris. My thinking is we love to see people fail and keep going. If you want doggedness, if you want someone who will not give up, even though he consistently fails in his objectives, Indiana Jones is your man. And for endurance alone, I think he deserves a place. But of course, he's also clever and actually values learning and exploration. While
terrible
you
teacher.
Could argue... Sorry?
Terrible teacher.
I mean, we don't know that for sure. You know, certainly his female students appear to be paying very close attention to his classes or something in his classes. I'm not sure what. But also, I mean, he is not quite as much of a cultural appropriator, if you will, as many of the people he's modeled on. In most of his films, he gives it back to the people who, you know, should have whatever the artifact is. Obviously, that golden idol at the very beginning of Raiders of the Lost Ark is something he keeps. The question of who the Ark of the Covenant belongs to is not one that I'm going to get into, but, you know, hidden is probably a good place for it, given what we know about it. But yeah, I think he's not a bad role model, all things considered. He, you know, is tenacious. He keeps going. He studies hard, kids, and he looks really good doing it. So we all be more indie.
He straight up punches Nazis, which, come on.
Yes.
Who knew that was going to be so relevant in 2020? But we need heroes on screen who stand up to fascists, punches them in the face. He does that. So good on you.
I would argue that the most satisfying sound effect in history of movies isn't a lightsaber being turned on or a blaster or any of the great vehicles of Star Wars. It is the sound that Indiana Jones' fist makes when it connects with a Nazi's face. It is absolutely glorious. I don't know what the Foley artist was doing. Were they just punching a side of meat? Who knows? But all for it.
He's probably Ethan Hunt's favorite hero as well, because all the stuff that Ethan and I say, you know, we'll figure it out. You know, I'm working on it. Indiana Jones is doing that 30 years beforehand, so it's great. But when you think of, if we were to do like a bingo, you know, card for all the, you know, coolest hero traits, Indiana Jones would sort of, you know, make the list on like very, very quickly. You think about, you know, cool look, cool iconic look, check. Signature weapon, check. Iconic theme, check. You know, the greatest balance of, you know, vulnerability, but, you know, what's the word I'm looking for here? Mm-hmm. Vulnerability, but
toughness.
You know, he has flaws. Toughness,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And he's got that too. A great trilogy of movies, check. I mean, I could go on. It's just insane. And then when
Harrison Ford in his prime, check.
Harrison Ford in his prime, check. The guy is sort of, you know, it's amazing. And then when you have people like Harrison Ford, and when you have people like Steven Spielberg and John Williams, put all that together, you got lightning in the bottle. And it's no surprise that he tops this list. And it's reason to a character like that to endure for 40 years and still sort of top this list really says it all. So yeah, you have chosen wisely, Empire readers.
I think I love the fact that he's on top of this list as well, because he is a purely cinematic hero. He is a hero who was designed for the big screen. So everything, like we said, from his look to the influences that he's drawn from, he is designed to be seen on the big screen, in silhouette, in person, doing these amazing acts of heroism. I love that sequence in Temple of Doom where he's on the rope bridge and the guys are on either side and he's got the machete in the middle, and you're like, and knowing how human he is, that he's just going to have to find a way to get out of this situation is so great and so exciting. And I think that's the sort of thing that you love Indy for.
Mm-hmm. No, I don't love Indy for.
Yeah. Also, to have a film such as, you know, Indy 4 and still to the top of this list just goes to show you how amazing and enjoying the character is.
Never heard of it, really.
Now listen, I think the character is phenomenal, and I've long wanted them to make a fourth Indiana Jones movie, and I believe Jim Mangold is working on one as we speak. Be interesting to see revisit this character in his dotage, so to speak, but if anyone can pull it off, it is Harrison Ford. And yeah, exciting. But they just ended in 1989 at Last Crusade and then made no more movies after that. And
did I dream that there was something about monkeys and gophers? And
no. It must have been a dream. It must have been a dream.
Weird, just don't eat cheese before bed, Ben.
Don't do that.
I rewatched The Last Crusade recently. It is still my favorite of the bunch because it's got all the stuff you know and love from Indy, plus that great father-son relationship. And that's what takes a little bit of the top for me. Yeah. That great moment when he's reaching for the grail and Sean Connery's like, let it go. And it just hits me every time. I freaking love it.
Indiana, let it go.
Yeah, that's so good. And a little bit of a shout out as well to River Phoenix for that wonderful young Indiana Jones moment in that movie as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that prologue is so great. And the way in which John Williams waits until we transition to grown-up Indy to give us that full-blown Indy theme is just chef's kiss brilliant. Which is why today on stream on Squadcast, my name is John Williams is the GOAT.
Quite right. Well, listen, that is it. We've made it to the end of the list. Indiana Jones, aka Henry Jones Jr., is number one on the list. And, you know, were we all happy with that? Do we feel anyone else should have been number one, or are we okay with that?
No, I'm okay with Indy.
It's fine. I mean, Kevin Conroy, Batman, but, you know, in the absence of that, it's fine.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously Steve Rogers, but apart from that, it's fine.
Bruce Campbell Ash, but apart from that, yeah, I'm okay with that. Let's talk now about omissions. Helen mentioned, of course, there's only 14 female heroes on the list, and I think there are only 3 black heroes on the list, maybe 4. Mm. So I think, is that reflective of the way cinema has been to now? Do you think this list of five or 10 years time will be significantly different? And you know, if you could name one hero that you think is a significant glaring omission, who would it be?
I mean, you'd hope this changes over time. I think to an extent it is a reflection of a history that is largely centered around white heroes, especially white men. And we're already seeing sort of changes being made on that front, and hopefully that will continue and rapidly grow in years to come. I think for me, if there was someone I wish was on this list as a recent example, it would be Katherine Johnson from Hidden Figures, the Taraji P. Henson character, who the whole point of that film is that these women were forgotten heroes who in real life did something absolutely incredible. Without them, you don't get the moon landings, and their story wasn't told, and it was told in a really entertaining way. Taraji P. Henson is great in that film, and the way that you see them battling the sort of massively racist views of the 60s, all the stuff about having to run 20 minutes across to go to the bathroom and all of that horrible shit, and seeing them not only fight through that but become part of this wider piece of history, I think is amazing. So I would have loved to see her on the list.
That's a very interesting choice.
Fully agree with everything Ben said. I don't think we'll be able to see the full impact of Black Panther for a while yet, but I do think that changed a lot of things in a big way. We've already started to see we've already started to see a little bit of the impact, but I think that's going to reverberate for a while. In terms of the hero I'd love to have seen on this list, I recently rewatched The Mask of Zorro. That film is awesome. And Zorro, not only sort of in that film, but if you think about his place in regards to Batman, he looms large in Batman's story as well. If you read the comics, if you watch the cartoons, I believe in some incarnations, Zorro was the film that his parents were going to see that the night that they were killed. So
it's true.
And then if you sort of look at what Batman's costume is compared to Zorro's, there are similarities there too. But The Mask of Zorro is a film I absolutely love. I would love to see Antonio Banderas in that role again. I believe there was talk fairly recently of a Django Unchained Zorro movie with Quentin Tarantino. Yeah, yeah. I know that there's a comic, with the two, which you should definitely read. It's really fun. So yeah, I would nominate Zorro to be on this list.
Fantastic. Good choice.
I've literally forgotten the start of the list at this point. Did we have Chihiro from Spirited Away? She's
nope,
phenomenal. Nope. Did we have Hermione from Harry Potter? We did. Okay. We had Mulan?
Nope.
Well, that's an oversight. Joe in Little Women. I'll take obviously the most recent, but really I'll take any of them. would seem to be a good one. We had Katniss, I know.
Yep.
I mean, it's hard to think of, and maybe Dorothy, actually, if we're talking big, big movies, Dorothy Gale, The Wizard of Oz. Yep. So yeah, I think there are more out there that we maybe could have added. But
absolutely. Well, listen, we've got to wrap this up, not least because I've got to talk to Simon Pegg in about 4 minutes, but who's not on this list, by the way. Sean from Shaun of the Dead is not on this list.
Yeah.
And I wrote down a
Nick
couple.
Nick Angel
from Hot Fuzz, where is he on this list? It's an absolute disgrace. What's going on? I wrote down a few omissions, and we don't have a lot of time, so I'm only going to mention one, which is Bub from Day of the Dead, the smart zombie that rips Captain Rhodes in two. Then, of course, it's Harry Lockhart from Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, Nancy Thompson from Nightmare on Elm Street 1 and 3, Laurie Strode and Dr. Loomis from Halloween. You have Andy Dufresne from The Shawshank Redemption, The Man with No Name, or Harry Callahan, actually, if you're talking to Clint Eastwood Trip. There's no Deadpool, there's no Kirk, there's no Spock, there's no Qui-Gon Jinn. What about Tequila from Hard Boiled? Where's he? Where's Rama from The Raid 1 and 2? There's only one Arnold Schwarzenegger character in this list. There's no Matrix, there's no Dutch from Predator. What the fuck is going on? Denzel Washington is completely not on this list. What the hell's going on? Where's Creasy? What? Hey, where's Creasy?
That's a point.
I don't know. Where's Ron Hunter from Crimson Tide? Were any of the characters from the Fast and Furious movies? Dom Toretto, Luke Hobbs, Han Solo, Jake Sully, or Neytiri from Avatar? There's nobody from the Guardians of the Galaxy. There's no Jack Sparrow. There's no Woody. There's no Buzz. There's no Morpheus. There's Neo and his Trinity, but there's no Morpheus.
Do we have a Jack Ryan?
There's no Jack Ryan.
Or Marco Ramius?
Nope, none of those. In terms of comedy, there's no Frank Drebin. There's no Sean, as I mentioned before. There's no Nick Rivers from Top Secret. There's no Ron Burgundy. There's no Ted Stryker. Oscar Schindler should be on this list, don't you think? What about Harmonica from Once Upon a Time in the West, or Bruce Lee from Enter the Dragon, or Cyrano de Bergerac from Cyrano de Bergerac? What the fuck is going on? Listen, we could probably do another podcast on omissions alone, but I only just wanted to mention one or two that I thought deserved to be on the list. And on that note, it is goodbye from Amon Warman.
Amon Warman will return in another Empire podcast. Peace.
We need to work on that title. It is goodbye from Ben Demption himself, Ben Travis.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from Leia Cake, Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to rant some more about the omissions. I mean, seriously, Tequila from Hard Boiled? He takes part in the shootout whilst having a baby in one arm and he's on fire in the other one. What's going on? Anyway, incredible film, incredible list. Thank you so much for listening. See you next time. Bye.